wars between Protestants and Catholics. They had one particular day where thousands upon thousands of Huguenots were killed on St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But France is, as I wrote here, France is entitled to be among the leaders of the Reformation despite the wars and contests between the Guise family and the and Catherine de Medici that we'll talk about as well. She played a rather significant role. 5 years before Luther posted his thesis, 95 Theses on the door at Wittenberg, 5 years, so 1512, another Reformed monk was preaching reform in Paris. His name was Jacques Lefeu, and he was born around 1440. They didn't keep the accurate records that some of us do today in Picardy. He was a Carmelite monk. I know you all remember this already, but we talked about the various houses of monks or monasteries, and the Carmelites were one of them. He had a reputation for being for having an inquiring mind, and curiosity kills the cat. We all know that, but curiosity also leads us to learn and understand and find out new things, and he was certainly that. He was a scholar. He traveled abroad. He studied history, mathematics, philosophy, and theology. He was an expert in Greek and Hebrew, and as well as Latin. I mean, he would have had to have known Latin. And for his attainments and leanings toward the humanists of the day, he was admired as a true scholar in that sense. And even at a late age, do I have any of this? Yeah. Even at a late age, he was appointed professor of theology at Sorbonne in Paris. He believed change was necessary. And he's right. Because the idea of the Reformation, and we talked about this when we began the Reformation, was always reformed, but always reforming. If we ever get to a place where we say we have arrived, we are in trouble. Because we have not yet arrived. And so he saw change as necessary. He was open-minded, which again, we need to be open-minded. That doesn't mean that we just allow everything to come in and take it without being critical of it. I had an interesting conversation with someone this past week, and we were talking about what does it mean to be in the world but not of the world? Because the reality is we are of the world, right? So what it means is that we need to understand our culture. We need to engage our culture, and that doesn't mean just with vitriol, not just decrying how wicked and vile our culture is. I saw a meme this week that just made me chuckle. It said, the Roman Empire is going to hell in a handbasket, said no apostle ever. Because their concern was not the Roman Empire. Their concern was the kingdom of heaven that was coming to earth. And we get lost in that sometimes. And we say we don't want to be worldly, but at the same time, we put our eggs in the world's basket. And so we just need to think about that. So being open-minded doesn't mean that you are just, you know, take whatever comes to you. What it means is that you take every thought captive to make it obedient to Christ Jesus, as Paul says. Okay? He read the Bible, which was unique for men of his age. He saw it as a treatise for the lives of saints. And in so doing, he was struck by the concept of salvation by faith alone. In 1512, again, 5 years before Luther, he published a commentary on the Epistle of Paul, and he wrote, "It is God who gives us by faith that righteousness which grace alone justifies to eternal life." That is a profound statement. And it was a statement that Luther would make later, but he already had come to that idea. And again, the reason he came to that is because that's what the Bible teaches. And so he's studying the Bible. As you would well imagine, he became a suspected heretic. But he continued to develop his ideas, and he had two very attentive pupils. One was named Peter Olivetan, and the other was William Farrell. Farrell would play a significant role in the life of Calvin. So Farrell is the one who convinced Calvin to come to Geneva, and Olivetan was a cousin of Calvin, and actually Lefebvre had translated the Latin scriptures into French. And he published the first French Bible from Lefebvre's original copy. Farrell began to preach alongside of Lefebvre. Farrell had been a priest, abandoned that, began to preach with Lefebvre, and their efforts began to have a significant impact on the people of Paris. And ultimately, it came to the attention of William Briconnet, who was the Count of Montbrun and Bishop of Meaux. My French is not real good, so bear with me. He had been to Rome, and while at Rome, just as Luther had when Luther was younger, gone to Rome, and instead of being inspired in the faith, he was disillusioned, because he saw the debauchery and the wickedness that was surrounding the church at Rome. And so he comes back, and he is given a Bible by Lefebvre, and that Bible transforms his heart, and he becomes a Protestant, becomes a reformer, and he becomes the most influential reformer in France, such that... again, he's the bishop of an area, so he was able he issued a mandate in his diocese on October 1520, where he denounced dissolute priests who were derelict, that they were just not doing their job. He also forbade Franciscan friars from the pulpit. That's pretty significant, because he was saying you're not preaching the gospel, and the gospel should be preached from the pulpit. As a bishop, he preached regularly, which was uncommon. Most bishops did not preach. They were really glorified administrators, if you will. And then he established a seminary to train future pastors. Again, he's now in the context of we're not raising up priests for the church, we're training pastors to preach. And that was a very different model for the church at that time, because primarily priests were trained to do the Mass. That's what they were trained to do. And anybody could learn the Mass and do the Mass. But not everybody could preach. And so they were training these pastors to go and preach the gospel. He had many influential friends, including King Francis I and Francis's sister Margaret de Valois. She was the Queen of Navarre, and we'll get to Navarre in a little bit. Navarre is between Spain and France, so in the mountainous region of the Pyrenees. Anybody been to Navarre? It's not its own country anymore, but at this point it was. She was given a Bible by Briconnet, and she was converted to the Protestant faith as well, which will play a significant role as we move along as well. The The head of Sorbonne in Paris, however, was a committed papist. His name was Noël Beda, and he forced Farel and Lefebvre to leave Paris. The Reformation in France was very successful outside of France, but the monarchy and the church were very careful to keep Paris safe from the Reformation. I saw that they celebrated the Mass today at Notre Dame for the first time since the fire. I was thinking, Wendy was at Notre Dame on an Easter Sunday, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, and she said it was the saddest place she'd ever been. Just no joy, no delight, no nothing there. Francis I, King of France, is captured by the emperor, who is Charles V, we've talked about him a lot, at Pavia in Italy, which left France in the hands of his mother Louisa. And she is aided by Antoine Duprat, the chancellor, and by Noël Beda. The Valois family had a long history of persecution of the Waldenses. We talked about the Waldenses. They were a pre-early reform movement in France, although they had some really crazy ideas. And the Pope actually sent troops to have them destroyed. So the Valois family had a long history, and so to Louisa falls the task of rescuing France from Protestantism. They didn't want to go the way of Germany, which had already sort of succumbed in large part to the Reformation. In 1523, she was given this counsel: use the stake. Not S-T-E-A-K, S-T-A-K-E. But Parliament was not as enthusiastic. They summoned Briconet before them on April 12, 1523, and they threatened to burn him. Let's just get this over with. Briconet declined. It's not clear whether he recanted, but he said something that allowed him to get out of his punishment, and he was fined and ordered to make three edicts. He was to restore public prayer to the Virgin and the saints. He was to forbid buying and reading books by Luther, and he was to silence the Protestant preachers. Farel, at this point, takes himself to Switzerland. He realizes the handwriting's on the wall. And Lefebvre goes first to Strasbourg, and then he goes to Nérac, which is the home of Margaret de Valois, who is the Queen of Navarre. And at this same time, in August of 1523, a young man arrives at La Marche College in Paris, and that is John Calvin. So all of this is going on at this time, okay? So as the Reformation sort of begins to take hold in France, darkness and intolerance descends, and the martyrs begin to pile up, literally. They're burned at the Place de Grève in Paris. It is later going to be known as the Madame la Guillotine, when the revolution comes. The first martyr in France was a man named Pavan. He first recanted and then took back his recantation and was burned at the stake. And hundreds followed him afterwards. The martyrs were both lowly, the peasants, and the high society folks, highborn, if you will. One of the highborns was a man named Louis de Berquin. He was from the Artois family. So he is from the royalty family. And he was a man of letters. He enjoyed books and learning. And he had a dispute about the Gospels. And this is absolutely remarkable. He went to the Bible to find the answers. Again, in the Roman Catholic Church, if you had a dispute with someone or about some theological issue, the last place you would go would be to the Bible. You would go to the church teachings. You would try to understand what the church has said about these things. He goes to the Bible. And to his surprise, he finds the doctrine of Luther there, not the doctrine of Rome. The true gospel is dangerous, and we need to understand that. We need to understand that. And it is the power of God for salvation to all who believe, as Paul tells us. He urged the Reformed creeds on all that he knew, and he became a prominent evangelist for the Reformation in France. Again, the papists in Sorbonne took their revenge in 1523. They arrested him and tried him for heresy. But remember who he is, all right? He's part of the royal family, so Francis intervenes and he is released. He is seized again and released, and the king tells him to be more prudent, all right? Just tone it down a little. A third time he is seized, and there seems to be no escape at this point. The king is prisoner to Charles, the emperor. But somehow Francis sends out an order dated the 1st of April, 1526, and secures for a third time his release. Finally, in March of 1529, where am I here? In March of 1529, he was imprisoned again, awaiting trial. And while he was there, he remembered he had incriminating papers at his house. So he gets a courier to go to his house. Oh, he writes a letter explaining what needs to be taken, sends the messenger to his house. Well, on the way to his house, the messenger collapsed. They search his body. They find the letter. And he is now incriminated. It's interesting, as the story goes, this messenger was running down a road, and there was a statue of the Virgin Mary, and at the moment that he saw the statue of the Virgin Mary, he succumbed. The king appeals one more time, but during that appeal, The papists knew, well, the papists knew that an appeal was going to come again. So they hastened through the heresy charges, condemned him, and executed him at the stake on April 22nd, 1529. All right? If you just get it over with, then, you know, that's all there was. Interestingly, Berquin, who's not a famous reformer by any means, but he became significant. He sort of got the last word, if you will, because what he did was point out the wickedness of the Roman Church. They dressed him in a cloak of velvet, put satin on him, a gold hose around him, as if he were attending the king. When he went to speak his final words, the soldiers cried out and had a drummer playing too loudly so that they couldn't hear him. And the people did not forget that treatment. The people did not forget how they treated this prominent person. Francis sought German Protestant support, right? Because he's got an enemy in Charles V, who is the emperor. Charles V is a committed Roman Catholic in Germany. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. So he seeks to make an alliance with the German Protestants. I was trying to come up with a word. It was a chimerical union between Romanism and Protestantism. And then I realized You may not know what a chimerica is, so I have this little cartoon. A chimerical is merely imaginary, fanciful, fantastic. A chimerica was we have those in Ezekiel. You have the body of a leopard and the head of a lion and the wings, right, of an eagle. So it's this mismatch of things that don't go together, but they're put together, all right? So that's what he's trying to do. I mean, how on earth do you forge an alliance with Protestants at this point, right? I mean, they're just killing each other. But he wants to get back at Charles. Ultimately, that scheme didn't work. Although Bucer and Melanchthon, who are now in charge of Lutheranism, were very much in favor of it, partly because they were, I don't want to call them pacifists, that's too far. They were very much against warmongering. They just didn't feel like war was always the right answer. So they were in favor of this union with Francis I. But it came to nothing. All it did really was irk the Catholics in France, that he would have the audacity to try to reach out to the Protestants. And the Protestants were irritated because they felt like they were being, you know, why don't you forge an alliance with us and not them? So on October 24th, 1534, the Protestants made these placards, these scathing signs against the Mass, and they distributed them all over Paris. In fact, most all over France. And one of the places that they placed it was at the king's private apartment at the castle of Amboise. And this it generated this response from the king. Let all be seized and let Lutheranism be totally exterminated. He was not going to put up with that. And the bloodbath and martyrdom in France began in earnest at this point. Really led again by Beda, who is at the university in Paris. The priests would spread lies about those who were reformers. I think I've said this to you before. A gossip will only tell the truth when it will do more harm than a lie. Often lies are effective because you can impugn character, you can assassinate people with your words, and that stirs up the people. And once that's done, it's hard to undo. It's hard to undo. See if I can move along a little more quickly here. They actually had a ceremonial burning. They just gathered a whole bunch of people and had a big party on the 21st of January, 1535. They just, you know, we're going to show you. Another significant event at this point was the arrival of Catherine de' Medici. She was the bride of Henry, who was the king's second son, King Francis's second son, Henry. She, Catherine, was the niece of Pope Clement VII, so she had some rather significant prodigy as well, or, yeah, that's not the right word, heritage, we'll use that word. And she was under his protection and sort of became the de facto ruler of France, or he was. So their first son, Dauphin, dies. Medici and Henry's first son dies, leaving Henry II as the only heir to the throne. Francis I then dies, and Henry is made king, only to die as well. Then within a year or so, his son Francis II, who was the husband of Mary, Queen of Scots, okay, getting all these dots connected together, right? He died, leaving the younger brother, Charles IX, as king. And he was, well, as we would say when I was a kid, he was dim-witted, right? His light did not shine very brightly. And often, you know, we probably because of the inbreeding, they always had one or two or a lot of them like that. So he is the king. Catherine, you know, she's lost sons and husband. You know, she's just, everybody's dying around her. And she sort of holds it together and soldiers on. She's determined that her family is going to survive. She is often painted as the nemesis of Protestantism in France. But she was actually remarkably tolerant, given her family background. She worked to... She was expedient. Whatever was for the best interest of her staying in a place of power, that's what she would do. And she believed that some sort of alliance needed to be worked out with the Protestants if that was going to be the case. She summoned a colloquy, which was just a gathering together at Poissy in 1561 and was behind the Treaty of Saint-Germain in August of 1570, which mirrored an earlier piece that had been written. It allowed freedom of conscience in religion within specified locations. That is, you can worship freely in anywhere you are except in France or in Paris. You can't worship, you can't be a Protestant in Paris. There's some evidence that she did not order all of the murders on St. Bartholomew's Day. It appears that she wanted the leaders killed, thinking that once they were out of the way, then she could deal with the peasants and the lesser people, if you will. But many Catholics, or those who were in charge of that, being rather zealous, took her word literally and executed all and any they found, including 1,000 non-Huguenots. I mean, it was an awful day in France. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands were killed on one day. Where am I here? Despite the many casualties, however, Protestantism was not stamped out. Protestantism really didn't get stamped out of France until the French Revolution. The French Revolution did Protestantism in, because the French Revolution also did Roman Catholicism in, because it was secular through and through. I mean, the main difference between French Revolution and American Revolution was that there was a decided religious element in the American Revolution that was completely missing in the French Revolution. When you have people like Voltaire leading the charge, it wasn't that hard. The Huguenots made themselves strong in La Rochelle and in Montauban. That they had been given that territory in earlier treaties. They declared themselves ready to fight the House of Guise and the king himself. They declared the king a traitor and a murderer. And many Catholics joined their support. They were tired of the endless bloodbath that was going on. Charles IX is unable to rule. Again, he's incompetent. And the country was in chaos until he died in 1574. The crown then passes to his brother Henry of Anjou. There's something very famous that comes from Anjou. Pears. Pears. They're the best kind of pear. Anjou. He becomes Henry III. And he was one of the authors of the massacre on St. Bartholomew's Day. His mother, Catherine de' Medici, had him elected king of Poland because they needed a king. Well, elect my son. It was much like elections go around the country or around the world here. It's not fair and free, right? You put somebody up and there's nobody else running. So he becomes the king of Poland. But when he hears that his brother has died, he rushes back to Paris so he can claim the French throne. Henry, like his Henry III, like his mother, Their convictions were only such that was necessary to take and hold power. Whatever's the most expedient for us, that's what we'll do. So when he decided it was to his advantage, he made peace with the Protestants. They were granted freedom of worship, except, again, in Paris. You can't have Protestant churches in Paris. This incensed the Duke of Guise. And he declared war on the Huguenots with the help of the Spanish troops. So eventually, Henry III joined them. This was the eighth, put this in perspective, this was the eighth in a seemingly endless series of wars between Protestants and Catholics in France. And none of them solved anything. The Huguenots were too weak to defeat the Catholics, and the Catholics were not strong enough to stamp out Protestantism. And so it just goes on and on and on. Then the youngest of the sons of Henry II and Catherine de' Medici dies. No heir. The king had no heir either. He didn't have any children. So legal succession to the throne now belongs to Henry Bourbon. Bourbon is the king of Navarre, whose wife was of the royal family but a Protestant. He had been a prisoner in Paris during the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, had changed his religion for the fourth time, although not the last. He declared himself then to be a Protestant. All right, so the Huguenots didn't like him because he was licentious. He lived a very deplorable life. However, the true heir to the crown of France was a Protestant. And so sometimes you get behind people that you don't like personally, or you don't like their behavior and antics. Okay? I'll just leave it there. The Catholic Party could not tolerate this. How on earth can we have a Protestant king? So they had to find another solution. When the king died. So they put forth Henry of Guise as the rightful heir to the throne. Now they have absolutely no, he has no royal pedigree, right? But that didn't stop them. They just conveniently unearthed documents at Lorraine showing the House of Guise was descended from Charlemagne. Therefore, its right to the crown exceeded that of the Bourbons and the Valois, right? He becomes the number one guy. So there was now three parties, each headed by a Henry, Henri. You have the legitimate king, Henry III. He was probably the least worthy of the three. You have the Catholic pretender, Henry of Guise, whose claims are based on documents that are absolutely false. And then the Protestant chief, Henry Bourbon, who did not claim the throne. He just simply claimed the right to inherit it. Okay, so you have three Henrys. And war breaks out again. Surprise, surprise. Until Henry... where am I here? Yes. The war ensued that dragged on until Henry of Guise took Paris. And so Henry of Guise now proclaims himself king. Henry III now takes action against Henry of Guise. 2 days before Christmas 1588, Henry of Guise was murdered at the same place, 15 years earlier, where the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre had taken place. Okay? I don't think it was a coincidence. This did not put an end to Catholic opposition, however, because few were ready to trust a king who repeatedly used political assassination to keep the throne. So the Catholic rebels found new leaders and continued fighting. Soon the king's situation was desperate, and he had no alternative but to flee Paris, and he flees Paris and takes refuge in the camp of Henry Bourbon. Okay? The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Okay? This didn't last long, however. A fanatical Dominican friar, convinced that the king was a tyrant, entered the Protestant camp and killed the king. Henry Bourbon, who was clearly the legitimate heir, took the name Henry IV. But the French Catholics were not ready to have a Protestant king. So, Philip II in Spain was planning to make himself master of France. If there's a vacuum of power, somebody's going to come in and take it. So the Pope declares that Henry Bourbon's claim to the throne was not valid, and the war continues. Finally, Henry decided that the throne would never be his unless he were Catholic. So he changes his religion again. I'm not sure about his convictions here. The year after his fifth conversion, the new king entered Paris and ended decades of war. Interestingly, he showed loyalty and favor to the Protestants, so much so that the Catholics claimed that he was still a heretic. So finally, on April 13, 1598, he issues the Edict of Nantes, which is probably the most significant document in the Reformation of France. It granted Huguenots freedom of worship in all places where they had churches, except in Paris. Right. Henry continues to rule wisely, but religious hatred and prejudice did not just go away. It was still very much there. Henry ultimately would fall victim to them in 1610. His life was ended by a Catholic fanatic who again was convinced that the king was still a Protestant heretic and that he was serving God by killing the king. You get all that? And we think we have it bad. And the other, I was thinking about this the other, I hear both sides of politics today decrying, well, one side says 12 years from now the world's going to be ended, and the other side is, we've lost the war, we've lost the fight, This is nothing new. It's nothing new. God is still in control. And his kingdom that we serve, unlike every other kingdom on earth, will last forever. And I think ultimately, much of Protestantism, particularly, was undone by overzealous nationalism, by tying too closely your religion with your nationality. And we have to be very careful that, because it's easy for us to do that. And we have to be very careful. It's not that we can't be patriotic. It's not that we can't be, very happy to be this nationality or this, citizenship. But that has to take a back seat to my citizenship in heaven. And if it does not, then this is an idol that I need to destroy. And we need to always keep that in front of us. Always. And that, again, that's true across the political spectrum. It really is. We just need to be very... I was having a conversation with someone who came out of the Bible Presbyterian Church. We'll get to the various Presbyterian groups. But in 1936, a group of students left Princeton Seminary to form Westminster Seminary. Machen was the leader of that move. One of his students was a man named Carl McIntyre. One year later, after the OPC had been formed, he decided that they were heretical, and he needed to found a new denomination, which was the Bible Presbyterian Church. And it was he became a big fan of McCarthy in the 50s. He was when you went into his church. In fact, it's still there. His church. He died in 1991 or something. If you go into his church, across the pulpit behind, in huge letters, it says, "Be ye separate." And he wanted America to be separate from the world. He was very much a protectionist in that world. We're always fighting with one another, and that's the hallmark of Protestantism. And I think we just need to figure out what are the things that we have in common. Is the gospel being compromised? That's always the first question we have to ask when we are dealing with others, non-Presbyterians, if you will. Is the gospel being compromised? If the answer is no, then we ought to be able to put up with a whole lot of stuff. A whole lot of stuff. And I'm still trying to learn that lesson. It's always hard when I get into a mixed group and I just get all worked up. And then I realize I have to spend eternity with these folks. Right? I have to spend eternity with them. We'll get it all sorted out there. But if the gospel is not being compromised, then they are our brothers and sisters. Right? I mean, we all have families, you know. But they're no less our family, just like those who may not agree with us on this or that or the other. All right? All right, any thoughts or questions? Yes? At this time? So at this time, all of the stuff that we talked about in Germany is going on. The Church of England comes out of the Roman Catholic Church with Henry VIII in England. All of that's going on. The Low Country is battling and trying to figure out all of the provinces and who they're going to follow. So that's going on. So all of these things are taking place at the same time. And there was a lot of crossover. You know, Knox goes to visit with Calvin and other reformers in Switzerland. Luther often sent men to various other places on the continent to strengthen and bolster Protestantism. To the point where much of early Protestantism in the Netherlands was Lutheran, and Lutheran gained a foothold in the Baltic states, not the Baltic states. Scandinavia, there we go. Same general area. So that Finland, Sweden, and Norway become Lutheran. And then those emigrate to where it's cold like it is there, Minnesota, and it's Lutheran. And that's why Lutheranism is there, because of all of those things. So, yeah, and we have to bounce back and forth because we have to sort of look at each section and how is it being developed in that area. We finished the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century now. Next week, please come next week. We have Colin and Zuri Jennings, who are coming to share about their work in their missionaries that we are supporting now. And they are going to be working with college students in Senegal, which means that anything that we publish or post can't mention them, where they're working, because it is a dangerous place to go. And so please come and hear about what they're doing and where they are. Hopefully they'll be heading off late this summer so that they're there in the fall. And then the week after that, we'll look at the Counter-Reformation. What steps did the Roman Catholic Church then take to reform itself? Okay, and we'll we'll see some interesting things. And really, those changes are going to shape the Roman Catholic Church well into the 20th century. Okay? Anything else? I realize this is a 30,000-foot view, but I'm trying to give you a flavor of what's going on, and how significant the Bible is. The first hallmark of the Reformation was sola scriptura. If you lose the Bible, you lose everything. You lose everything. Because then you become God. And that's a dangerous place to be. All right, let's pray. Lord,